Ringgit and Cents on BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good morning, you're listening to Ringgit and Cents, the show that's all about personal finance. I'm Melissa Idris with Julian Ng. Andrew Stotz joins us again today. Andrew is an advisor to the fund manager Fortress Capital, and he's here to share some ideas of how to become a better investor. And while we will always remind you that homemaking your own investments is a risky endeavor, there are always opportunities for learning on how to invest. Let's get started, shall we?
The first question that I'm going to ask you is an existential one, because there's this whole passive versus active debate that's going on. Passive meaning that people don't believe that you can beat the market, and active people try to make a lot of money by beating the market. So my question to you is, should people in fact learn to become good investors?
Well, I like the topic of become a better investor, because it doesn't say whether you should be active or passive. It says your responsibility is to become a better investor. For some people, it may just be completely passive. But for other people, it may be active as far as finding a fund manager. And for other people, it may be actually picking stocks. But to completely ignore the market and ignore investing, you're doing yourself a major disservice for your retirement and for the money that you need to make sure that you've got a comfortable life. So this is the reason why most people need to start thinking about investing, not because, hey, I want to go and make some money in the stock market in the next 6 months because I want to buy a car.
Funny you mentioned car, because that's the analogy I always use. You might not be a car engineer or a car mechanic, but you understand why you would need to consider thinking about a car or thinking about other modes of transportation. So while you're not an investment technicalist, you still need to think about investments.
Yeah, and you have to learn how to put petrol in the car. You have to learn how to read the gauges to know your speed and know if there's a red flashing light. It's true that you can't just get in a car with no knowledge. In fact, every country in Asia, as well as Malaysia, requires you to be licensed to operate a car and drive it.
So can you translate that to investment work? Is there a kind of step-by-step guide that one can use to become a better investor?
So I'm going to ask three questions to you. The first one is, do you have an interest in investing? If the answer is no, you should be buying a fund. But if you'd say, I'm interested, let's go to the next question. Do you have time?
Very apt question, because investing is like establishing a second career. You've got so much work to do.
Well, I mean, if we establish the fact that professional fund managers who are actively trying to beat the market find it very difficult and they're working full time, what chance do you have to say, oh yeah, at the end of the day, I spend an hour checking out the newspaper and then I make my investments? Then you just have a random chance of outperforming. So if you say that, no, I don't have time, I have interest, but I don't have time, I'm sorry, but you should be letting someone else do it through some sort of fund. But if you say, yes, I have interest and yes, I have time, the next question is, do you have knowledge?
I can almost guess what's your next suggestion to that is, because if you don't have the knowledge but you're interested, the next step to do is to seek knowledge.
So yeah, because you're interested and you have time. If you don't have knowledge, you can seek knowledge. And then I would ask, you know, I would start with some basic books and say, how many books have you read on investing? I ask that question to people who talk to me about individual investing all the time, and they say, one. Or how many academic papers have you read? For instance, there's about 3 to 5 great academic papers that lay out principles.
You know, the kind of picture that you're painting right now is extremely daunting for somebody who answers that second question in the affirmative, saying, yes, I want to become an investor, but all this work that they have to do is so extremely daunting, added on top of the fact that they also would have day jobs. So how would this person divide the time between their actual day job and their careers and learning about investments?
So it's daunting. That's true. But think about it like this. The other day I was walking down the street and I passed a dentist and I thought, that could be a good job. And I went in and I asked them, can I become a dentist? And they said, well, yeah. I said, awesome. Can I start now? Huh? What? No. You can't start a job as a dentist or an engineer or an architect. You've got to be educated over a period of time. You've got to be licensed. You've got many, many things that you've got to satisfy. So the point is that why is it that people look at the finance profession, a profession that I've devoted my whole career to, that people think, oh, I can just walk in and start trading. In fact, as I always say, the less you know, the more you're welcomed into the world of finance.
Right, right.
It's just like a casino.
Exactly. And a lot of people are circling around you like vultures and sharks, waiting to tick a piece of your investment or your savings out of you in terms of commissions or fees. But I would also like to ask whether you're setting this up in a certain direction, because essentially the subtext that I'm getting is that it's so hard to become a dentist or an engineer that you might as well leave this to the professionals. Is that what you're going for?
I would say actually no. In fact, the best option, if we talk about the purest option, if you said, Andrew, I just want to know how can I have the best performance in 10 or 20 years from now? The best option in Asia, because we don't have a lot of passive funds and because active funds can sometimes be expensive, right, and not necessarily perform, the best option for a person is to hold a portfolio of stocks. Why is that? Because commission rates are so low. That's the one area that's been competed down. If an individual knew a bit, if they had some interest, they had some time, they had some knowledge, building a portfolio of stocks themselves is a way of taking advantage of the one area where competition in the financial industry has really pushed down rates.
The million-dollar question is what you would include into the portfolio and how do you go about stock selection?
Okay, right? Yes. So I'm going to provide you. I've been doing some academic research okay. that I haven't published yet, but I'm close to it, and it's an interesting answer to this question. I asked the question. I've already done academic research and published a paper called 10 Stocks Are Enough in Asia.
Interesting.
What I show is that if you're going to buy individual stocks, do not own less than or more than 10 stocks. If you own less than 10 stocks, you're bringing on risk related to those individual companies that one of them could go bust and you're going to lose a lot of money. If you go more than 10 stocks, you're becoming just like a market or a passive fund.
Is this kind of like replicating your exposure to the entire opportunities and growth that markets offer just with 10 stocks?
Yeah, because if you buy a passive fund that owns the market, the problem is that you'll never get any stock-specific return. If one stock just goes up 50, 100%, that's not going to show in a passive fund. All you're going to get is the market return. So by buying individual stocks, but only 10...
I mean, certainly if a fund manager out there running a commercial fund invested in only 10 stocks, they will be vilified by the regulators and by market observers. You know, we're talking about commercial interests here that try to forward their own agenda. But if they can't do it, how can this work with an individual?
The research that I've done basically explains that by going over 10 stocks, you are not doing it for diversification purposes. You're doing it for another reason, such as you have a huge fund. You can't own 10 stocks, right? You've got to own 50 stocks. Or you've got somebody within your company in risk management says that you need to be fully diversified across 50 stocks or whatever that is. That is based upon some idea that somebody has. But my argument is based upon research.
So what you're saying is that if a fund is managing about $10 billion, they don't have the luxury of putting all their money into 10 stocks because that would be extremely risky for that amount of money. And
exactly.
There is no avenue to funnel that money into because these stocks are just too small for that amount of money.
Correct.
Right? So the individual investor would have that advantage because very few people have $10 billion.
Correct. And that, you've hit it. We've hit the advantage for the individual investor because, number one, commission rates are low. And so the individual investor can take advantage of that. Number two is that the institutions just can't invest in 10 stocks. Last question that we need to ask is, okay, Andrew, I got the idea that I should own 10 stocks and I have an advantage over a big fund, but how do I select those 10 stocks?
That was the exact question I was going to ask because I'm so curious.
Yeah. So this is where I've done some recent academic research and I thought, well, how can I give the advice to the average investor and tell them, for instance, study for 10 years and learn about this and, But I asked the question, what if you just randomly selected those 10 stocks?
Like a monkey?
Yes. And so I simulated that. And I simulated the process of randomly selecting 10 stocks and measuring the portfolios. Now, if 1,000 people randomly selected 10 stocks, what I'm talking about is once a year. Once a year, you select 10 stocks randomly.
So that this would involve kind of overhauling the portfolio every year.
Correct.
With 10 random stocks.
Correct. Now, it's crazy because who would put stocks into a portfolio randomly?
How random is random?
We can do it randomly by getting a list of all the stocks that are listed in the market that are tradable, obviously. Mm-hmm. And then easily in Excel, as an example, you can just do a random number generator and put it next to each one. Or you just go down the list and you just say, blindly throw a dart.
You're listening to Ringgit and Sense with Andrew Stotz, advisor at Fortress Capital. Coming up next, find out more about Andrew's academic research and how you can become a better investor. BFM 89.9. Good morning. You're listening to Ringgit and Sense, the show that's all about personal finance. Here's Julian Ng with our guest this morning, Andrew Stotz, advisor at Fortress Capital, discussing how to become a better investor.
And in your research, when you choose something that's random, what do you end up with? Do you get a diversity of industries and sectors?
Generally, by randomly selecting, you have the possibility that you could be overweight a sector, the wrong sector, or that you'd be neutrally weighted across all sectors. But the fact is that if we're talking about the success of somebody who doesn't have a lot of experience, the idea is that if you're going to go and try to overweight yourself something, you're probably going to be wrong too. So the point is that you randomly select 10 stocks and you hold those 10 stocks for 1 year. And I basically ran this simulation over 5 and 10 years. And for 1,000 people, you have 1,000 different outcomes that looks like what I call a fan diagram, where you can see someone may get, you know, they put in 100 at the beginning, they may have 1,000 at the end, and someone may have 70. Mm-hmm. Right? They may have below the amount they put in. So there's a fan diagram that you see that, but 80 to 90% of the time, you would beat a passive fund because you would be getting this this stock-specific risk. But so the second part of the research that's more interesting is that I said, well, for the average Joe, let's say that you buy 10 stocks and one of them goes down a lot. What should you do? Just sit on it? Well, that's where I brought in the concept of stop loss. What I've said is that if you put a stop loss on that portfolio of, let's say, 20 to 25%. That means if you bought the stock at 100 at the beginning of the year and you held it for 12 months, and any point during that year it went down to 80, it went down by 20%, you sell it. And you just hold cash, you tell the broker, hold that cash until I rebalance at the end of the year. What would happen is that that fan diagram that I have would shift up so that the worst outcome would actually beat the passive fund.
Okay, I think the investment world is always promulgating this mantra that the higher risk you take, the better your returns will become. High risk, high return, that's the normal mantra. And it also highlights the relationship between risk and return. What does this show in the research that you have done, especially when you do this 10-stock selection process, you end up like a passive fund? I mean, that's the thing we want to avoid, being a passive fund if we do our own investment, right? We want to beat what passive funds are doing, not including the learning costs that we have to go through. I mean, it has some hidden costs as well.
Well, I mean, this process, there's some time, right? You've got to get a list of all the stocks. You got to randomly select them. You got to give that order to the broker, and then you got to give them the stop loss. So it does take time, but it's not a lot of time. And I would advise in that case that you just don't think about it for 12 months, and you give the stop loss order to the broker, and then they must execute that. So from my perspective, it takes a little bit of time, but not that much. And you're not getting a passive fund return. Remember, a passive fund owns every stock. You're owning a selection of stocks, which means you are exposed to stock-specific risk.
So you either do much better or much worse than a passive fund.
Correct.
Yep.
And that's where the stop loss prevents you from doing much worse.
So in terms of the kinds of risk and return from your research over the past 5-10 years, what does it show? What kind of returns can one expect?
Well, you're going to get an average return over that period of time that's going to be slightly better than the market.
Slightly better than the market.
Yeah, because you're taking on the company specific risk, those 10 stocks.
And right? The risk? Are the risks proportionate to the returns?
Well,
compared
that
to the market?
Brings up a whole other question, which is what is risk?
And the volatility, of the portfolio.
Which I always say, we use volatility in the world of finance, mm-hmm. but I would never use volatility in my own investment.
Why is that?
Because whether something goes up and down a lot doesn't really matter to me over the long run. In fact, if you told me, hey, this is going to go up and down a lot, but it's going to be a much higher return at the end, I would choose that.
That also raises an interesting question about how long-term people should be when they do their own investments. What do you think?
Well, I think that sometimes, you know, we have a lot of regulation in the financial world, and one of them is that we've got to assess people's risk and return, and you're going to get all these surveys asking about, you know, your level of risk and all that. But we have to remember that sometimes these things can get out of control. And what I would argue is that if people are, if advisors are putting people into low volatility investments, they are also doing that at the expense of a low long-term return, which basically means that if you needed $1 million to retire, you're going to end up with $500,000 because of what this guy's saying. Mm-hmm. So that's another risk that's called shortfall risk. And you don't get covered in the financial world by protecting someone from shortfall risk. But if you can protect them from volatility, you're going to get a bonus or you're going to be appreciated.
Okay. At the risk of turning this show into something that's more and more technical, we don't really want to go there. But when you say that you don't consider risk in your investment because of the long-term returns, surely risk must be a consideration, because it depends on when you go into the market. For example, if you went into the market in 2003 and the crisis happened in 2008, yep, you have lost all the gains made in the previous five Correct. Years, right? So risk actually comes into consideration.
Okay, so now you're talking about the risks that I understand.
Okay.
Losing money.
Or at least the potential or the probabilities of losing money, right? Because I don't want to take disproportionate amount of risk for a given level of return.
Yep.
I'm getting technical here, but you know, I'm trying hard not to go there.
Well, let's keep it simple. First of all, the methodology that I'm testing through my academic research that I've just presented is a methodology that's about selecting stocks. It's not about market timing. So the first risk that you're talking about is kind of the market timing. Should I be putting my money in at this time, right? So that's the first thing. I'm not talking about that right now. But the second thing is, let's talk about risk. That's the purpose of the stop loss. If a stock falls from 100 to 80, we sell. And if you implement a stop loss like that, that's your best protection of risk, because at that point, 20% down, what you're going to find is that the probability of that stock continuing to fall or not rising is slightly higher.
Can you give us some figures? For example, there's this very technical thing called the Sharpe ratio, which measures the amount of risk for every unit of return that you get. I mean, this is part of that dashboard thing that we're looking at if we buy a car or something, right? So to me, the Sharpe ratio is one of those dashboard matrices. What is it? Well, don't give us the Sharpe ratio, but what are the risks compared to the market or a passive fund? Are you taking efficient risk with this process?
Well, I guess this goes into a technical subject of risk, which we won't go into the technical aspect, but I would just say that a Sharpe ratio that's based upon the volatility of the portfolio, I would challenge anybody that that presents that as a measure of what we would call risk-adjusted return. I don't believe that that's a risk-adjusted return measure. It's a return which considers volatility. But if your objective is to reduce volatility, you are naturally going to reduce return. And so my biggest point is, be careful about Sharpe ratio or what we call risk-adjusted return. It's a measure that has some value. But what I care about is truncating the downside, which basically means removing that downside as best as you can.
If I can put it in a very layman's term, a layperson's term, right? There is a difference between buying a stock and a work of art, for example. To me, the work of art would be a lot riskier, because if I try to sell it in the next 5 years, I may not get a price for it. But for a stock, at least, there is that intuitive feeling that the risk is commensurate with the returns.
So there are many different types of risks that we're talking about, such as the liquidity risk that you just mentioned about art. That is a liquidity risk that, oh my gosh, when I'm ready to sell this, there's no buyers, there's no market for it because it's not a liquid asset. So definitely when I look at randomly selecting stocks, I'm talking about, in this case, and I'm talking about research that I'm doing, right? So, but when I looked at it from a research perspective, I can tell you that you don't want to do that in stocks that have tiny little bits of trading volume. You know, otherwise you couldn't get out of it. But for the average individual, they don't have that much money. So it could be pretty low amount of volume that, a bigger fund couldn't afford.
Okay. What amounts of money should people consider when they want to DIY their whole investment process? Do they put 100% of their assets to play around with in this random process? Or should they have, you know, this concept that, you know, suggested by some people, a core portfolio versus a satellite portfolio, in which a satellite is a much smaller portion of your wealth that you can play around with?
Well, I would say the most important thing about investing is actually investing. Most people talk and study and think about investing, but they don't actually invest. And that, what I mean is, on a regular basis, saving and taking that savings and putting it into the market. Mm-hmm. So for most people, they actually never end up with a significant amount of money, even though they read the books and they listen to the, you know, programs and all that stuff. So the most important
thing...
And that's
not a bad thing, right? Yeah. Because they can then have the chance to leave the bulk of their wealth to other professionals to manage for them.
Well, what I'm just saying is that majority of people who are new to investing never actually save.
Okay.
You can never get... The key to ending up with a lot of money at the end of your life is being able to save every single month. The benefit of a core portfolio concept, let's just say that it's a passive fund or it's an active fund that's not too expensive, as an example, then in that case, the benefit is that you're building up your nest egg. You're seeing it every month, it's growing and all that. So I definitely think that there's value in that core concept of, this is the one thing, if I don't know what to buy, that doesn't mean you shouldn't buy. You should continue to contribute to that. So that's what I would say.
You raised some very serious points about behavioral issues, the fact that we're not disciplined enough to do it so often. So should one actually expose 100% of the wealth to a self-management process, or should they split that to some passive or active managed fund?
Well, how do you feel when you lose 20 or 30% of a portfolio? If you panic and you're going to sell out, then you probably, which most people will feel, you probably do need to focus on a somebody that's going to manage and help you manage that money. And I think for most people, you need some of that, whether that's passive or active. And then for the another portion, you know, you can try to invest it yourself and see how it goes.
Unfortunately, that's all the time we have for Ringgit and Cents today. We'd like to thank Andrew Stotz, advisor for Fortress Capital, for taking the time to talk to us about how to be a better investor. Now, if you missed any part of this interview, you can find it on our website or our BFM app. Stay tuned for news at the top of the hour and Enterprise after that. BFM 89.9.
Ringgit and Cents on BFM 89.9, the business station.